as I hope to say the same as I just said 2 minutes ago. No, we appreciate working with you as chairman of the committee in developing a committee substitute for the Senate Bill 145. There was a title change to show that this will be a matching grant. I think that was a good addition. And in Section 2, it very clearly states that a matching grant up to a maximum of $500,000 for utilization of in the planning, engineering, architectural site development of a Native Cultural Center. And so I do support the work that's been done.
Thank you, Senator. I might add that we also did put down some of the specific accomplishments or tasks to be done with the money. We changed that from phase one to more specific sorts of things, including planning, engineering, architectural design, and site development. And I think that that offers a little more specificity to the use of the monies. Is that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And it still gets into the basic issue of the state's role in this, and that's one that from the policy issue that's going to have to be debated. I can only state, and I may have done this before, that we have for a long time wanted to see a cultural center. It's been looked at for many, many years. This goes back to my days on Planning and Zoning Commission and basically looking at the area that's being considered right now. It could be a major draw for tourism that benefits all the way from southeast and the steamship lines to the railroad and north to Fairbanks and then filtering out into other parts of Alaska. And I don't see this as being in opposition to many things the state has done in terms of trying to develop those kinds of facilities that are going to draw people really on a national and international basis. So I feel strongly this is a good project. Again, the basic policy issue, should we be here? I think we should.
Thanks, Senator. Questions to the bill sponsor? Thank you very much. Carl Myers, Mr. Myers? Want to state your name?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Carl Myers. I'm the Senior Vice President for Cook Inlet Region. With me today is Lydia Hayes, Executive Director of the Siri Foundation, and we're both here on behalf of the Alaska Native Cultural Center Board. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to express serious appreciation to you and the committee for the opportunity to provide our comments in support of SB 145. I believe that all the members of your committee were in attendance at the joint committee meeting of State Affairs and International Trade held on the 27th. Therefore, we'd like to state for the record for this committee that we believe the project would be very beneficial to the state and its people, not just Native people. It allows for the Native people to retain, learn, and expand on their culture, and at the same time to educate other Alaskans and people from all over the world to learn about the indigenous people of Alaska. I'd like to, since there was quite a bit of testimony given at the last joint committee meeting, I'd like to just go right into questions, committee, if you have that, of myself or Lydia Hayes, and we will attempt to try to answer to the best of our ability any question you may have, if that's okay with the committee.
Questions of Mr. Myers or Ms. Hayes? Senator Kelly.
Well, I would say, Mr. Chairman, I had serious reservations about this bill the first time it came before the committee. I like the idea of the matching grant. I think that's a good idea. I've always liked the idea of the cultural center. I didn't like the way it would appear that we put up all the money and they got all the tourists, but that's neither here nor there. I like the idea of the matching grant. I think I might even be prepared to co-sponsor this legislation at this point.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I think that in discussing this bill with Senator Strzelewski and her staff, that's something that we can support. It's a change from what we had seen before on a 65-35, but I think we can support that bill. And Lydia can get into more detail if you wish about how that would operate. But I think for the state funding to apply to the engineering, design, planning, and architectural phase of it, I think we can live within those bounds and those means.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much. Ms. Hayes, did you have anything more to add?
Mr. Chairman, only if there would be questions to ask. One thing I might want to say is that this project is truly a private-public undertaking, and this was very clearly pointed out in the feasibility study report, so I just simply want to underscore that.
I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS, Mr. Chairman.
I move National Unanimous Consent to adopt the State First Amendment Substitute for Senate Bill Number 145.
Any discussion or objection? If not, we'll adopt the CS. Is there a motion to move the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move National Unanimous Consent to Senate Bill 145, State Affairs, move out with individual recommendations.
Discussion? Any objection? If not, CS for Senate Bill 145, State Affairs, will move out with individual recommendations. Thank you, Chairman. The next bill before us is SB 170. This is a return to a not so long ago bill that passed the legislature establishing new procedures for the state procurement efforts and code. This is an administration bill, and I think Mr. Link is here. Would you care to offer testimony?
My name is Bob Link. I'm the Director of the Division of General Service and Supply, Department Administration. We're involved with procurement and have been part of preparing the procurement bill. Just to give you some background, prior to 1986, there was a Senate Select Committee on Procurement Practices which developed what was the procurement bill at that time. And rather than start from scratch, they started with a document called the American Bar Association Model Procurement Code and started working with that document. Unfortunately, that document is a model, and it wasn't designed to cover all the circumstances, so they had to tailor it some to fit the unique requirements of Alaska. And it also envisioned a large bureaucracy, or rather a huge bureaucracy, managing the entire purchasing of the state, and they decided that wouldn't work. So they found, coincidentally about that time, they found another state who had recently implemented the procurement code in a much more abbreviated version, and designed, after going through a number of processes, figured out a way which would make it work for a smaller state, and that was the state of Arizona. So the committee took Arizona's legislation and then what I'll refer to as Alaskanized it to eventually get the legislation which was passed in 1986. We started writing the procurement regulations and discovered that some areas wouldn't work. We couldn't figure out how to make them work when we got to writing regulations. And so in 1987, the legislature passed, or we had introduced, and the legislature passed an amendment which revised some of the requirements in the procurement code. So in the beginning of 1988, the procurement code actually the first day of operating on the procurement code started. And in that time, since between 1988 and now, we've discovered some areas which are, call them, in some cases rough edges, some cases difficult parts, in some cases things which don't seem to quite meet all the requirements. And so we started looking at ways of amending the procurement code to make it work a little better, perhaps in some cases more efficient. And we started out by sending out questionnaires to all the departments asking for their recommendations. And then we took their recommendations and put them through a screen. And the idea was to not argue with the original intentions in the code, not to get involved with trying to avoid things which would be controversial and then hence delay the process of an amendment to the legislature. And we had a bill prepared and then sent it back to the departments for comments, incorporated in some of these comments, again, taking the same filter of avoiding, trying to avoid controversy and avoid addressing some of the basic parts of the code. And so we'd hopefully avoid philosophical discussions. And amended that, and then finally that became SB 170. I think the transmittal letter with SB 170 is fairly clear, but I'd be happy to go through each one of the changes, or just answer questions, or come back and go through each one of the changes after the other people have testified, or whatever serves the pleasure of the committee.
At this point, I think what we will want to do is probably have your reaction to some of the additional amendments or problems that other witnesses may raise, or have a chance for you to react to those. Let me ask you, is there anything among the various amendments proposed that you or the administration see as at all, going any significant step away from the original intents or purposes of the
I don't. That was our idea, was to try and keep those out, because we didn't want to get involved in discussions where people said, we don't believe in that. He said, let's, you know, whether we have an argument or whether it's something with the way it's done, let's assume that the law's in there. So now let's, how do we make it work better? And so that's efforts we've trying to come up with here.
In my reading through it, I must admit, I didn't see anything that struck me as earth-shaking, but I was not intimately familiar with the original bill, so it was hard to judge, I guess, what the original intent was. But it did look pretty modest as far as the scope of the proposed amendments. Is there any questions of Mr. Mike?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, are there going to be other people testifying in DOT?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll be here as long as we can.
I also note, Mr. Baldwin, in the audience, are you here to answer specific questions?
If questions come up, I agree to be there.
Senator,
the process of developing a CS, is that what
all these are? Yeah. Pardon, a CS? No, those would be explanation or rationale and those for the changes as proposed by the administration. We do have members of the university and also the railroad corporation that are proposing additional amendments for our consideration. And the hope here is to bring all these out, run them back through Mr. Lincoln, Mr. Baldwin, and others, and see if there are some additional amendments that the committee might want to entertain. Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator. No,
this amendment that's before us, is that the one that's going to be considered in the CS?
This would be one that we would be considering.
Thank you. But, Mr. Chairman, your intent is to take testimony today or pass the bill on today?
Take testimony today and then consider additional amendments. Brian, Mr. Rogers, you want to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Brian Rogers. I'm Vice President for Finance for the University of Alaska, and we're very interested in this legislation. I know in your packets is a letter from me to you that deals with some of the issues that are really important to us. We've had significant problems implementing the procurement code, some with the law and I think some with our interpretation of the law. As I talk with Bob Link, I find areas that we may have overly complicated our own lives. But our biggest problem has probably been in the area of research procurements, where we have specialized scientific knowledge in the principal investigators, and they have had a hard time adapting to the code for subcontracts with other universities, research equipment, and supplies. And the timeliness of the process has had significant impacts last summer during the research season, and we're hoping to avoid that this year. And I think some of the amendments that are in the bill and that we're proposing address some of the concerns. And I'd like to address briefly the items I did in the letter and then add one that's come up since that time. First, on the first area of concern we have is on the Alaska business license requirements. We had raised one issue in the letter that we've been assured by the Attorney General's office can be dealt with in regulation, and that is what is evidence of a business license? And under the state's regulations, application is evidence, and so we will amend our regulations, and you can ignore that suggestion in the letter. The second one is more material, though. The Alaska Business License Act, AS 4370, contains a number of exemptions. You are not required to have an Alaska business license if you're an insurance company, if you're in a fishing business, if you are not in a business for pecuniary gain, if you are mining. Several others are not required to have business licenses. And yet, in the Act, the procurement code says you must have a business license at the time designated for bid opening. The state has apparently addressed this by regulation, but we'd be more comfortable with a change in law that would say that if you're required under the Business License Act to have a business license, you must show it at the time for bid opening. But if you're not required to have a business license, you don't need it at the time of bid opening. And we think that would take care of some problems we've had. For example, if we are doing a subcontract, if we're going out to bid for work that's going to be subcontracted to another college or university, we've had a hard time explaining to the University of Arizona or Mary Knoll or whoever it may be why they need an Alaska business license in order to have that subcontract. Because when we subcontract with other universities, we don't need a Nebraska business license or a California business license or what have you. Since the colleges and universities are not in business for profit, this amendment would exempt those areas from that business license requirement. The second area we have of real interest is in the area of exemptions from AS 3630, the procurement code. One is contained in the governor's bill that we asked for. There's another we support. The one that we asked for is in subsection 25, which is on page 10 of the bill. It would exempt research supplies and services that are funded by other than state money. The we just went through a federal audit of our procurement practices, and they have expressed some concern over provisions in the Alaska law having to do with bidder preference, the business license, and then some of the steps don't completely fit the federal process. We do about $20 million worth a year of business with the federal government, and we don't want to jeopardize that. We would like to follow the rules that come with the federal requirements and not use the state requirements in lieu of those. The two additional areas that we've identified that are in the letter, first is registration fees for conferences and workshops. This is mostly a paperwork reduction request. Right now, when someone goes to a workshop, we have to file a sole source determination that this is the workshop. And in fact, most of them are sole sources, and it's just an attempt to reduce the requirement to go through that sole source determination. The same on guest speakers and entertainment. While that's a professional service, and the trigger isn't really until $25,000, if we wanted, as the example in the letter, Ronald Reagan to come and speak at the university, we think it's kind of ridiculous to fill out a sole source determination that, you know, there's just one person that is Ronald Reagan to come and speak. The third area that is not in the letter that came up on Friday, that I do not have a specific suggestion on how to address this yet. We just, in the last year, scored a contract. We stole it away from the University of Nebraska. It's a $2 million a year contract to operate what's known as the Polar Ice Coring Office, or PICO. And that office is responsible for logistics for ice cores taken in Greenland and Antarctica. And my office was asked by the folks who are going to be at the camp in Greenland this summer how they're supposed to do procurements over $5,000. At their field camps, are they supposed to send out for bids for 21 days in Alaska and apply the Alaska bidder's preference? On the face of it, it seems pretty ridiculous to me, and I'm not sure what the best way, other than to a blanket exemption on procurements for foreign field camps. That would certainly take care of it. There may be a better way, and I hope to provide you with a written suggestion on what an amendment might be, but that will also be a problem in the Antarctic project should we get that major contract. The third area that we're interested in is probably the most controversial of our requests. And was, while I think there's no objection by the governor's office to this one, it's one that, as Bob Link said, they wanted to avoid controversial amendments in Senate Bill 170. And that has to do with the bid limit. Under the law as it stands now, you go through the complete procurement process with advertising for bids for 21 days, the 10-day period after the notice of intent for all procurements in excess of $5,000. If it's under $5,000, you can use a less formal process. Normally that involves several telephone calls to get quotes. We're suggesting that that level be raised from $5,000 to $10,000. That has, I think, a positive impact for us and other agencies, and I think a positive impact on what it is the code is trying to accomplish for Alaska businesses. The advantage to us is that the cost of procurement is fairly high when you go through the complete bid procedure. And as a percentage of the job on a $5,000 item, it costs a lot to buy things at $5,000 or $6,000. The process is much simpler when you can get three or whatever our appropriate number of quotes. In terms of the other thing is we have to mail to everyone who's on the bidders list, regardless of whether they're in-state or out-of-state vendors, if it's over $5,000, and notify them of the opportunity to bid. Normally, when one would do telephone quotes, we're going to take advantage, if there are local vendors, we're going to call three local vendors or whatever is appropriate for that procurement. And my guess is more procurements would end up going locally. They wouldn't have the out-of-state competition from those who have been required to be notified between the $5,000 and $10,000 level. I know for President Kelly, this is an argument that he heard 2 years ago and was rejected at that time. I think you may find the vendor community would not have a significant problem with such an amendment, but because it was specifically addressed 2 years ago and turned down, I think the governor did not want to amend it at this time. For comparison, the state of Oregon uses a $15,000 level for small procurements, and the federal government uses a $25,000 level, below which they have a much simpler process. The next area that we have some concerns about is on page 7 of the bill, section 16, having to do with protests. The question is, when should a protest be able to stop the procurement procedure? Under existing law, if we issue a notice of intent to award, we may, and there's a protest, we award unless we find the protest has a reasonable chance of succeeding. This turns that, this amendment would turn that the other way around and say we do not award unless there's a reasonable probability it will be denied or if the delay is contrary to the state's best interest. We can live with this as it is in the bill, but our concern is that for the price of a postage stamp, a person can hold up the procurement process. And while the person who's filing the protest may feel aggrieved, there's also a company sitting out there that just won the bid and is being deprived of the ability to provide the service by the protesting bidder. And it's hard, you know, the CPO has to make the call, is this a frivolous or is it not a frivolous protest? And our thought is, if the winning bidder has some cause of action against a protester when it's a somewhat frivolous claim, that might tend to reduce the number of protests that hold up all this process. The second issue is we do think that the law should require a detailed statement of the legal and factual grounds of the protest. Right now we get protests which are somewhat vague. I suppose the CPO could just rule it out of hand, but I think a requirement that the rationale for the protest include a detailed statement would help to ensure that we get fewer frivolous protests. The final area is one of penalties. We may be partly guilty ourselves of scaring people somewhat by the penalties. The code enacted fairly stringent penalties for the procurement officials who make the final determination. And some of our people are concerned that while they know the law, when they're dealing with a lot of transactions, they make inadvertent errors. And they're concerned that the law as it reads now on the civil penalties makes them liable for all costs if they make a mistake. We would like to add the word intentionally so that a person who intentionally contracts for services in a manner the person knows to be contrary to the act, that would be the circumstance under which someone would be civilly liable, and not if it's only knowingly. And the criminal code has a definition of intentional versus knowingly, and basically the standard proof is a little bit higher on the intentionally. There are several sections of Senate Bill 170 that we find that were amendments that we also supported. Many of the sections don't apply to us. If the choice were yes or no on it as is, we would say yes. We think the other amendments we've suggested would make the law easier for us to deal with and are compatible with the spirit of the law. My understanding is the Alaska Railroad will be coming in has one amendment, concern about people who are, we've seen similar circumstances, who are effectively hanging up a shingle that says, I'm in the business of doing something, when what they really are in the business is taking an out-of-state vendor's bid, tacking on 4.75%, and taking advantage of the 5% Alaska bidder's preference. There are ways administratively to get around that on some purchases. For equipment, for example, if what we ask for is equipment and the ability to service the equipment, that tends to keep those people out of business. I think if I'd been a little smarter than I am, I would have gone into that business a year ago because it's very profitable taking advantage of the Alaska bidder's preference. It's something that I don't think was intended by the law, but it's happening out there now, that people are setting up garage businesses to take advantage of that 5%. I had a chance to look very briefly at the Railroads Amendment, and I think that would solve part of the problem. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have or could respond in writing to any in the future.
Mr. Rogers, I just have one clarifying question. I kind of got lost between your amendments 2 and 3.
Okay.
What was the amendment that spoke to the Antarctica
bidding? Okay. That's not in here.
Oh.
That's one that came up on Friday, just before I came down here, where a new circumstance that we really weren't aware of. So it's not in this packet, and I'll try to give you something in writing.
I would assume we can talk to Mr. Link or Mr. Baldwin, but I assume that some one way or another, our Office of Foreign Trade has run into similar situations or has chosen not to be worried about that. I don't know, but I'm sure that they have a
you know, their foreign offices must have a much different, they do have services and they do contracts.
Yes.
And things.
But the volume is likely to be fairly small in a foreign office. Most of the things they procure other than space are likely to be able to be procured under small procurement rules. And that's the case in most of our field camps. The PICO is the first big one that's come along.
Questions, Mr.
Chairman, just on that same point, of the chairman's point, and that was that we were supposedly got a contract that we stole from the University of Nebraska, is that
yes.
correct? And therefore, in that contract, it's going to require us to go to Antarctica and do all this work on core samples and what
yes. and to Greenland. The,
and
to
Greenland, the two areas.
Yes.
And your concern is that, well, here they are in Antarctica and they're miles away from everybody and they have to go send a piece of paper in or something, is that what you're
right.
saying? Well, can't there be some kind of an exception for an international expedition like that or something?
I think about a three-word amendment or a one-phrase amendment under the exemptions that begin on page section 17 on page 7 would be the way to address it.
Any questions?
Mr. Rogers,
thank
you very
you.
Much. Just to keep continuity here, I wonder if we could have Mr. Link or Mr. Baldwin, if you would comment on those suggested amendments.
First of all, you know, we recognize the university has different problems than just basic government. I mean, we're operating under, you know, we have different planning things. We don't have the research, so we don't know exactly what their specific problems are regarding research. But at the same time, there's a lot of similarities in that there's procurement and it's spending public funds and it's spending rather Alaskan public funds. So the business licenses, that was one of the areas where we you know, received a number of comments from agencies that they just don't do away with the business license requirement. Business license requirement is required as a part of another portion of the statute, and I believe, and we perceived at the time, that the business license was placed in the procurement statute, not as a part of having people covered by the Department of Revenue or making the $25 certificate fee, but rather of a Buy Alaska approach. That is, people who had business licenses were more liable to be here, or that if they were had business licenses in the state, they would have had, you know, intent beforehand with doing business with us. So, you know, we didn't, even though we got a number of recommendations from agencies that was causing them problems, we didn't address that area. To add, you know, we wouldn't, and, you know, in general, we feel that it's the legislature's prerogative to define who gets the benefits of the Alaska business preference and that sort of thing. So, but in general, we wouldn't have any problem with adding business license requirements or reducing business license requirements, but just in one point, to say that the only people who had to have proof of business license or one who required them under the other statute would mean that a firm located outside the state would no longer have to have a business license just for sending us something by mail, as I understand that. So called the Buy Alaska intention of putting the business license requirement in the procurement code would probably be dropped back out again at that point.
I follow that. What about using the example that Mr. Rogers did about a university that normally would not be required to have a business license, you know, making them have a business license? How does that relate to what you said?
Yeah.
I think the argument was we have certain exceptions from business licenses,
right.
which I assume includes universities
yeah.
And then other people too. That was one part of the argument, that maybe those people at least would not be required to have a business license.
And it may be that the nonprofit type of organization, such as a university, is would not be covered under the section covering business licenses. But at the same time, the other people who would not be covered under that same statement, that is, you don't have to have a business license, would be Ajax Enterprises in California, who wants to sell us materials. So it would be, you know, in order to maintain the Buy Alaska effort in that area, and at the same time exclude the universities or other nonprofit type of organizations which wouldn't be covered in our, so we have to look at that very carefully. And that's sort of superficially what I can give you, except for that's sort of the reason we stayed away from that area, is because the original intent was Buy Alaska, and every time you try and, you know, approach something which people put in with the idea of encouraging more procurement in state, you slow things down. So we'd stay away from that completely. There is presently, and changing subjects here a second, one of the comments was federal funds, and there's presently a federal funds exclusion already in the law. And which was carried over from the previous law. And part of the problem is with dealing with federal funds is their requirements say no preferences, basically. The bottom line is no preferences or nothing which would amount to a preference. And we've handled that for a number of years just by
using the exclusion and basically crossing out our Alaska bidders preference block, say federal funds, and quoting the section of the statute. I don't know whether that would be applied to the same type of problems that the university has.
Mr. Chairman, on that point of federal funds, would that carry through all the way to every project that we have on federal funds, or is this just segmented into one specific area?
I think it's most money, which is federal funds, but somebody told me recently that their agency got some federal funds, and the feds weren't sure whether it applied to them, but they were going to see about doing something about it. But this is your basic money, which comes from feds. For example, the DOT highway funds can't use the preferences. Okay.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. So, explain to me how that relates to a case in point. There's lots of federal funds that come through DOT. I mean, millions and millions and millions of dollars, and they've got that lobbed all over the place over there in DOT. It's in all the departments and everything. Does that mean that nobody has to have a bidder's license at all then, because there's federal funds being utilized in all those different categories and increments? Maybe we'll get to DOT.
Yeah, that's fine.
And I'll ask that question because I have some more questions for DOT.
Okay, but anyway, there is a federal exclusion, and the feds don't like local governments to apply preferences, so that's that area. And the bid limit, university was correct. There was so much discussion over the bid limit last time that we just avoided that. Arizona is the state whose our procurement code was fairly modeled after. It has $10,000 as their limit. Ours is presently $5,000. And the bid list, which we do send out, requires people to have business licenses once again. So at least the people on our bid list, so we send out, even though some of them may be located outside, have Alaska business licenses. And the question with business bid limits is, we're comfortable with raising the bid limit. But the question always is that, you know, the idea of open procurement, more people get informed if there's a competitive sealed bid. Yes, it is more expensive to do that. And finally, the protest procedure. There's a sort of a conflict in the existing statute based on the assemblage of Alaskan language and Arizona language when they put it together. In the previous statute, our previous statute, we had a 5-day waiting period after the bid opened for protests. And so everybody thought that was a good idea, and they thought that extending that period to give time for people to protest would be even better. So we have a 10-day waiting period in our statute. And then the Arizona law has no waiting period. So our protest procedure, which was incorporated directly from Arizona's regulations, says you go ahead with the purchase unless you make a determination to stop. Since we have this purchase which is not going ahead anyway, we thought that to change the option to make it we stop the purchase unless we make a determination it's important to go ahead would be more in conformance with our law, and at the same time give an extra weight to the vendor side of an argument. And you know, we're handling problems with protests which are have no weight. People just complain because they don't like the other vendors or that.
There was two specific exemptions that were mentioned, one on registration fees for conferences and workshops, second guest speakers and entertainment. As far as registration fees for conference and workshop, I assume that this is something that conceivably could be a problem in other agencies.
Yeah. Well, this gets a little bit confusing. When we first got the code, we started, okay, what covers this? Well, this covers, basically the law says it covers everything. And then if you follow through the definition, it says you're going to get supply, service, or professional service, or construction when you're buying it. And when we determined that a conference fee, you know, you weren't getting any one of those things. So it's not really procurement. Now, if you hire a speaker, then you're definitely getting something. And we haven't had, we don't get into the speaker and entertainment type of procurement as much as apparently the university does. So I couldn't say where that's a problem. We haven't had people come to us saying, we got a problem with this.
So the rest of the agencies are not even taking registration fees for conferences into consideration of procurement.
No.
So this is something the university probably could unilaterally just stop doing.
I think so. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, then, that's a question whether there's a violation here or not. I mean, what does the law say? It either says it does or either you can't.
If you're not getting a service, or a construction or a professional service as part of your money, then you're not expending, you're not making a procurement under the code. And we don't see as a conference registration fee as you're actually getting anything for it, either a professional service or a commodity or a construction. So it's not a procurement.
I guess it's an educational kind of thing. Do we have a lot of people who are conferences? study this or that.
I guess it's one of those things that we could make it perfectly clear by doing the exemption. I guess the question to the attorney would be, by going out of our way to make this an exemption, are there other similar things that we hadn't worried about that we would be bringing into question?
It's hard to anticipate what might be opened up by that, but I don't think anything really major. I think what Bob is saying is correct. We looked upon it as we weren't buying anything that was covered by the code, and it seemed to us it was a small item to be concerned about, and we just dispensed with it, so it wasn't to be covered by the procurement code. We don't treat them as procurements.
Mr. Baldwin, if I could ask you an additional question that Mr. Link didn't touch on, that's on the civil and criminal penalties. I don't know how you would read that suggested language by having intentionally and then leave the knows in there. Does that mean it's intentionally knowing and just knowing? Or how would you read that suggested paragraph?
Well, not being a criminal law expert, I talked with Dean Guinelli of our criminal section before I came today to ask him about the university's amendment. And, in the sense that the words intentionally or knowing are used in the existing law, first of all, both words are used now. And under the amendment, to change it just to intentionally, we don't think there'd be a basic change in the meaning of the section. In other words, the way we would interpret it.
Yeah, that's my layman's version, too. If you already had knows to be contrary, and then
right.
I don't know how else you would contract against that except intentionally if you presumably already knew what the law was.
Right, we agree with that. And there also, later on in the section, talks about a scheme or artifice. To defraud, I think. Maybe those aren't the exact words, but those words connected, words intentionally or knowingly connected with the phrase later on, tells us in a criminal prosecution that you're going to have fairly specific intent. So we have not been prosecuting people who make inadvertent mistakes brought about by the sheer volume of their work or the fact that they weren't informed of what the law stated. We've not been prosecuting people to that extent. We have been. We have adopted a policy where we're going to undertake personnel actions against people who don't take enough care in their work, however. And that's something Mr. Link could address if you desire to hear more about that. That's a policy that he's formulating now and has, I believe, begun to implement.
Mr. Link, did you have any more comments on the university amendments? I didn't mean to cut you off there. Are there questions for the committee, Senator Yulin and Senator?
Just real quickly, Mr. Chairman. You know, I know you addressed a couple of things. One, possibly moving the bid limit from 5,000 to 10,000. I assume you support that. Is that correct?
Well, like I said, we're neutral on that. We left it out. You know, it would make work easier for the state. It'd make things move faster. To make procurement more efficient. But it received such a level of discussion last time that we didn't want to, move that up again. It was definitely rejected the last time we brought the bill came around.
And Mr. Chairman, my second question is on the paper trail. Is there just an enormous amount of paperwork involved in every department having to keep track of this and then send it over to you, and then I don't know what you do with all the paper, and then you're transmitting the paper to somebody else? What's the paper trail on it?
On the $5,000 or just in general?
Just in general.
Well, in general, there's more paperwork because there's determinations and required by the statutes and records. We kept there. We didn't have to keep before.
And Mr. Chairman, that means that every department has to turn those records into you, then, I assume, into your department.
Some records come to us. Some of them stay in what we call the procurement file.
Senator Adams.
Yes, that was my one of my questions was on a procurement question from 5 to 10. I'm hoping that when this bill comes up, that we'll have a chance to vote on it. I also support the $10,000 level. My second one was on what are we doing for procurement in Tokyo and in Korea and those foreign offices, because the question relates to what are we going to do in Antarctica or Greenland, and that's, I'd like to, you know, hopefully we have a uniform policy once we develop one.
Mr. Chairman, just in general, the way that we don't have all the ability within the department administration to buy everything for all the departments, so we delegate authority out the departments. Departments have authority, and some of it's based on their ability to do things. We issue most of the bids. So every department has the authority to buy up to the bid limit within their own authority. We only make regulations which is how they buy it. So my assumption is, I don't remember ever seeing a procurement made by our office other than perhaps the lease for the Tokyo office, which required a bid. So my assumption is that they're buying those $5,000 or less procurements within the ability of the office.
Well,
Well, if that's the case,
I don't know if that's
just
the
go
case.
By $25,000. Yeah.
That is a scheme or artifice to avoid the code. That is a felony.
Just having an office where people come in and receive some Alaskan material and are informed about Alaska may be different than a beachhead in the Antarctic. So there may be a great difference between this and anything we've ever done before. I mean, that type of project didn't exist when the procurement code was written, so there may be a new problem.
Senator, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The paper trail comes from the procurement code requires that there's any exemptions, and I'll get you the number of exemptions that are on my desk, and it's astounding. But I haven't had a chance to analyze them for a roaring floor speech yet. But if they determine that a sole source is required, they have to write up why, because the state was abusing the sole source. What they were using was, well, we didn't think about it last week, and now we have a time crunch, so, oh, we'll do sole source. And that was their excuse. So there's requirements in the procurement code to make them write down, why is this an exemption? Why is this sole source? Why is this different? Why couldn't they go out to competitive bid? The procurement code's norm is competitive bid. If you deviate from competitive bid in any way, you have to write it up. And I think that's just good public policy. I mean, that if they're going to deviate from competitive bid and competitive solicitation requirements, then they should write up why they did that. And that's what the paper trail is, and that's on file, and I'll read them to you, and they're amazing how many of them there are. There's like 364 of them in the course of a year. If you're taking a headcount on 5,000 to 10,000, I would be adamantly opposed to raising the limit to 10,000.
You lose.
Mr. Chairman, along those lines, when I was over in Tokyo, I had the opportunity of seeing the Tokyo office and meeting all the people there and so on. And I think in the case, I know that the lease was very expensive that they got for the office there and so on, but it was lower than most of the other prices in Tokyo. But as far as the personnel there, it seems to me, if I'm not mistaken, you may be able to correct me on it, that it was a sole source contract for all of it. But I think that was for personnel, so I don't know if that would be covered in the procurement thing or not, because it was for like three or four people and things of this nature. But it was in the range of, $250,000, $300,000. So I guess my question is, does that fall into this category or not?
I can't tell you enough about that specific procurement, but I can give you the generalities. If we hired somebody to do something, without a competitive process, then it's documented. It's in the file, it's on the list that Senator Fakes has, it's on our list, and there's a copy of documentation behind it why we did it. If we got a lease over there on our own as opposed to hiring an equipped office, that's covered somehow. And even the little ones, if they made little ones, are in the file someplace, but they're harder to find. I mean, there's audit copies stored in the department who makes the procurements. So, no, I can't answer your specific question. I can get you information.
Chairman, could you find out about that specifically on the personnel there?
We can check too with the trade office and see if they had any particular problems.
Well, supposedly they're supposed to keep them. If there's a trail on it, that.
Other questions?
Keep going.
Thank you very much again. We may call you back after the railroad testimony. We do have Mr. Turpin here from the Alaska Railroad, and I don't. Did you want Mr. Wood to
give me him?
Second here.
Okay. Changing tapes.
Go ahead.
I am Frank Turpin, President and CEO of the Alaska Railroad. I appreciate the opportunity to have a chance to talk to you about the procurement bill. I think Bob Link did a very good job of explaining the difficulties in writing a bill for the state to obtain a uniform procurement procedure, and I certainly recognize those and echo them, but I think it also illustrates the difficulties of writing a bill for the state agencies to use, and one that also is appropriate for a business to use by the same procedures. And that has really been the heart of our trouble. The bill is not designed for fast reactions and responsiveness that you need in making business decisions. We have an amendment we would like to add to the bill. I think you have a copy of a letter that I wrote, but there's a better one that is a small single page that I think all of you have as well, which is by Fakes. We find this amendment is just excellent. This would solve our problems. The only suggestion that I might have is in two locations where it says the Alaska Railroad, we might add the word corporation after that, and then there'd be no doubt. I think it's on the first and the second line. But with this language in the bill, we would be able to develop a procedure that would be quite satisfactory for procurement. I might add that we had a procurement code long before the state developed one, and we had exactly the same paper requirement in the event we deviated from the procurement, as Senator Fakes mentioned. I thoroughly agree with her that when you deviate from a policy, you need to document why you're doing it and exactly what is the reason for it. We had that all along, and we certainly would continue. Our most serious problem with the state procurement process has that it has added about 45 days to our procurement process. And I think Brian Rogers described in very good words exactly how that happens. You have so many different steps that you must take and so many appeals that it has required a longer time for us to buy anything. We have found that it has increased staffing, and I think that where that can be handled, it still is. It hasn't added anything to the efficiency of the railroad or improved the railroad operation in any way. The legislature developed a bill for the railroad to operate under that was designed to make it self-sufficient and operate without any state funding, and we have been able to do that very successfully. But the more of these kinds of steps that we have to add to our operations, the less likely we are able to continue to operate the railroad without having funding from the state. Now the other addition that I'd like to propose that we make to the procurement bill that again Brian Rogers mentioned was covered in the letter that I think you also have a copy of. And on the last page of that letter, we have proposed a section that would be added that at least as a start in curbing this ability of people to work in their living room with a computer and really cause a lot of procurement problems to the purchaser and to the suppliers as well, but has not really contributed much to the state of Alaska. For example, we buy locomotive wheels a large quantity every year. We spend $350,000 buying locomotive wheels. There are only four manufacturers in the United States that offer locomotive wheels. We have one distributor in Fairbanks who has nothing but a telephone and a computer in his living room, who has tied up three of these four manufacturers into contracting with him, so that when we buy locomotive wheels, we now are only able to get two bids, one from the one remaining supplier and then one that represents the three, and he can control the prices of those three. And this year he very skillfully had it at 4.5%, so that we had to give him the order, and then he divided the order among the three that he controlled. So it was not within the intent of the procurement bill at all, and this is a substantial amount of money. 4% of $300,000 is pretty good earnings for not doing much other than that. We have the same problem in many other pieces of equipment that we have to buy. Usually they're locomotive parts or some special item that is not manufactured in Alaska. And this language perhaps should have some work done on it, but all we're asking is that the vendor have an inventory of at least $50,000, which would mean he would be a local businessman. I don't know of many businessmen that don't have some kind of an inventory of that level. And he should have that inventory at least 6 months before the bid, before he's a qualified bidder. Or else he should provide some service to us, a warranty or something of that sort. Mr. Chairman, that's really all I have to say. I won't get into the $10,000 argument or the $5,000 argument, except to say that there's very little that we buy that's under $5,000.
Mr. Turbin, one of the questions I've asked you privately, and be interested in your statements for the record on, if, and I don't know, we can ask Mr. Baldwin and others how your proposed new section 3630.035 would read there in your handout, or how it would be interpreted, but I think a question of lawmakers would be on how that would relate to the bidder preference for such things as railroad ties, where there has been quite a bit of controversy on whether or not to buy locally or not, and is that in some way designed to unilaterally not abide by bidder preference?
We try to buy everything that we possibly can, either locally or from the state of Alaska, and ties are a good example. We've had a very difficult time buying ties. It's hard to find a manufacturer, even Wrangell Forest Products, has a difficult time meeting our needs for ties. Right now, we're afraid that they will default on their present contract because they have not been able to deliver the ties for this year. So we will continue to buy whenever we possibly can from in-state if we think the in-state procurement source can deliver. I just can't tell you how that will happen until we meet the particular situation.
Yes, I guess it'd be, how would things be consistent with competitive principle, not and, but versus the special needs of the railroad? I guess that would be a question that, you know, would be lingering out there until, I guess, the board of directors would be kind of...
Well, we would have to, and we have this in our own procurement code that we will buy from the state, and we would try to do that, but there are very few things that are made in the state. The component parts for all of our electronic signals and things of that sort, just not available.
Other questions, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Larry Wood. I'm general counsel of the railroad. Mr. Baldwin will correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is that the Alaska Wood Products Preference is in a different part of Title 36, and hence this amendment would not impact that requirement.
Mr. Chairman, is this the only thing that besides just the amendment, the one that we have before us at the center base amendment?
Yes.
Or is there an addition to that that you'd like to add?
This is one. Another one protects against this vendor who has the computer in his living room. And that's in a letter that I...
Right.
But if we adopt this amendment, Mr. Turpin, you then could, through your own internal regulations, correct
absolutely.
The issue with the gentleman with the computer
absolutely.
In his living room. So this would be a
this
generic...
would solve my problem
right.
completely. I'm
yes,
just
right.
trying to put on a belt and suspenders.
Mr. Chairman, I think, and Mr. Baldwin, again, correct me, didn't you tell me that some court recently has struck down or looked disfavorably on the inventory... requirement?
Yes, there was a district court in Arkansas. I haven't had a chance to read the opinion. It's a fairly recent case. From what I can tell from the report that I've seen, the law was a bit more skeletal than what the railroad's offering here today. The law there required really that they have an inventory in a place of business, and the court struck it down as being vague. We have other problems with the inventory requirement. It's hard to be precise in this area without affecting a wide variety of people who legitimately do business with us who are dealers, for example, car dealers who sell us vehicles for our equipment fleet. I don't know that the $50,000 number is scientific enough to surgically handle that problem without doing a lot of damage to people who might do a high volume with us but have low inventory. So I think that if the committee is going to consider doing something like that, it would be good to let a draft CS sit out there for a week or two and see what you hear from.
Yeah, if we did what the railroad wanted, there are other vendors who are long-term suppliers of the state, long in residence and long-term participants in state procurement that would be eliminated. And we were able to come up with a few just brainstorming in my office. So that's why I think if we're going to do something for the railroad, a generic thing like this, and then let them make up their regulations might be more appropriate than trying to put that inventory thing in statute, because I think we're doing unsolicited good then, and possibly.
That doesn't help the university any. You have the same problem. That same guy, I think, is selling your...
It may be the same guy at the Fairbanks.
There is one
in particular that we have had a number of problems with, the bidding on things for out-of-state vendors and pocketing 4.5% or 4% or whatever. And I agree with Jim Baldwin that 50,000 may not be the right number. And I can think of a number of vendors that would be unfairly discriminated against. I think my point and my testimony was, what the railroad's trying to do is to end an abuse that's out there, and I'm not sure what the best way to end that abuse is, but I think that that what those people are doing is violating the spirit and intent of the bidder's preference and costing us money to boot.
I wonder, Mr. Baldwin, if you have thought about a reverse provision like we were talking about earlier about strategies that are outlawed to circumvent the dollar limitations. I wonder if there's more generic language that could be developed to prohibit practices whose primary intent is solely to serve to take advantage of the 5% without providing an appropriate level of service or associated business in the state.
Well, I tell you, Mr. Chairman, what I plan to do as soon as I leave this committee room today was to go and recount the fact situation that Mr. Turpin had just made before the committee and ask our antitrust lawyer whether we have got a violation here with this.
If we get the fourth one, we got him.
We might have him with three of the four. I'm not sure. I'm not an antitrust lawyer, but I do intend to inquire about that. So it maybe the problem is really an antitrust law, not to be dealt with in the procurement code.
Mr. Rogers.
What the railroad has is a particularly egregious example of it. We buy a lot of things for which, like the railroad, there are no vendors in the state of Alaska. And as a result, being able to buy directly from the vendor outside the state is preferable because of what that vendor supports to a living room entrepreneur who is marking it up 4.5% and taking advantage of it. I think your comment that that some penalties for people who are purely a markup operation taking advantage of a properly enacted bidder's preference might be the way of at least scaring some of those people out of business, and that might be enough to take care of it right there.
I can attempt to come up with a draft of a section. I couldn't comment until I made that effort, so I haven't given enough thought intelligent about it.
Mr. Baldwin, it would really be helpful, I think, to the committee if you could perhaps respond to both the amendment as the so-called fakes amendment and also the proposed amendment as submitted by the more detailed amendment by the railroad as far as the pitfalls associated with that, and then perhaps maybe some suggestions on, you know,
the
response
to the fakes amendment. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Fakes.
What I'm concerned about is if we focus in too specifically on this 5% bidder's preference. If someone takes us to court, the powers that be, the attorney mind, say that that's got a very, very good chance of being declared unconstitutional. And that we're just writing it right now. I mean, nobody's taking it to court, and that's why it's there. If we start really tightening down on that and really having penalties for these entrepreneurs who are violating that, I think you're going to get one of those guys taking us to court on that thing. I'm just worried about focusing too much attention on something that we know is not totally constitutional. It's questionable.
Well, at the same time, I think there is a concern that we, the state, not just be taken for a ride on some of these preferences.
Well, we're being taken for a ride because we have a statute in there that's probably questionable in nature to begin with, and people are taking advantage of it. I mean, if we didn't have it in there, then there wouldn't be anything to take advantage of. But because it's there and it's questionable in nature to begin with, these folks are having a wonderful time with it. I agree with what we're trying to do, but at the same time, I'm thinking that the more we focus on it, the more we could lose it. And I like having it there to encourage Alaskan businesses.
Mr. Chairman, you have to say they are businesses. You know, they are in Alaska doing something.
Yeah.
They used a little intuition on going to find a big old loophole and drive a truck through, I guess.
It wasn't.
If there's a way that it can be solved legally without having to go into days of deliberation about it,
I'd be glad to take a look at that and write you a memo for your next meeting. The truth of the matter is it wasn't worth anything when it was a 5% bid preference, but now it's much more.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to see that maybe you could work on this and, Mr. Chairman, adopt this amendment of Senator Fakes. I have no problem with this. I think it has some good merit to it. And then check to see with Mr. Baldwin if there's some other additional language that you could.
Well, it'd be our intention to float all of these suggestions around and give them some full review here and see if we can come up with something to solve some of the most egregious examples.
Mr. Chairman, also we're also going to be looking at, I guess, up in Senate Finance, so if there's something that rears its head later on that could be fixed up there, we can also do that there.
Thank you, sir.
Sure. Ms. Wood, is there anybody else that care to testify on this bill? I know we have Representative DOT. Did you have any comments?
We just wanted to answer the one question if you still want to.
Mr. Chairman, I have some questions for DOT, and I don't mean to belabor the afternoon. I guess we've lost the rest of the committee, but
now's a good time.
Go ahead. My name is Lauren Rasmussen. I'm with DOT, and I'm Chief of our Design, Construction, and Maintenance Standards Section.
Well, let me just address this question. I've been doing the subcommittees on DOT up in Senate Finance. And one of the things that came to our attention had to do with the state equipment fleet and with the bidding procedures on that with the 75 companies up in Anchorage that had some questions about how the bidding was being handled on it, and that they felt they were sort of unfairly dealt with, and so on and so forth. And I was just looking in the first part of the bill, and on section 2 here, if maybe that would relate to it, but there's some question of how that's being handled up there. Is there any way that we can correct that in our bidding procedure here in our this procurement bill?
Section 2, I think, is the one where we that the cost estimates would be withheld and are part of the confidential. And
you support that?
Yes, very much so. The reason for doing that, it's one of the long-standing recommendations out of AASHTO and a group of other people on preventing bid rigging. And that's the major reason for it. It seems to give a benchmark for people to know what to bid to. And if they have that benchmark, then that's the mark at which they start the bid rigging. And so when you look at other sections of our state statutes that allow or require that you release information, we were concerned that we would have to be able to or have to release our construction estimates. And that was the major reason for putting it. We would still give ranges so people had some idea whether they really should be interested in those procurements, whether it's for the state equipment fleet or our construction projects. We still would give ranges, and that's what we presently do. So that would, how it relates to the state equipment fleet, I'm afraid I could not answer that specific question, but I can sure get the answer for you.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I don't have the memo in front of me. There was about 75 companies, and I don't know if anybody else in the audience might know about this, but it was the 75 businesses and anchors that were bidding on the state equipment fleet. Or having to do with it for Schauberg construction. Do you know about that, Frank?
We
can pull it for you. We have
you
it
bet.
There. Senator Fakes, do you remember that?
I'm sorry, Joe.
The other question you ask, and maybe I should just make sure you clarify it, was the preferences.
Yes.
For the bidder preferences. Actually, you're looking at another state statute or another amendment on SB 45, and in SB 45 on the position paper, we actually spelled out how that section works. Happens to be in CSR 23-365-107E, and it says something to the effect that you can't discriminate during the bidding process for bidders. So you have to allow bidders to bid, but when you actually award, then you can have the awards for your state. In other words, they can have to have a business license and a contractor's license, but it's at the time of award, not at the time of bidding. And that's the differential. In our state procedures, we require it at the time you open up the bids, and they must have it or they're non-responsive. The federal system, they can bid, but you can't award until they have it. That's the major difference. The other major difference is there's a much difference between bidder's preferences for bidding and product's preferences. And under the federal system, we have no product's preferences. So under the federal system, you're not allowed to have product's preferences at all. So we don't have any product's preferences under our federal system.
Thank you very much.
You betcha. Thank you.
Anybody else have any comments or questions on the bill before us? If not, we will circulate a lot of these suggestions and
Mr. Chairman, how many commodities is through Mr. Lincoln, Mr. Baldwin, do we purchase products that the product's preference, the bidder's preference for products is utilized in the state of Alaska? Maybe we could just eliminate product's preference and take care of the railroad's problem and the university's problem with these mm-hmm. home computer folks.
Yeah.
Or would that mess up the food and the milk and the Matsu dairy and the potatoes and all that kind of stuff?
Actually, the product's preference is probably the best, you know, in-state support preference.
Okay.
Because it says it affects its value added here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Whereas
okay.
the business preference just says business passed through here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's not a solution to our problem. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, we concur on that. The product preference is the one that probably does more to stimulate the local businesses. And it isn't just a markup of something made outside, but is focusing on making things inside. And I think in terms of the legislative goals, that's the best one you've got.
Well, if there's nothing else to come before State Affairs, stand adjourned.
Mr. Lane? Oh, I
have
such an oven. There's
really
23 difference between the hallway and the
I apologize, I didn't follow that.